U.S. vote counting continues in a few key states as President Donald Trump and his contender, Joe Biden, both claim to be ahead. Post-election rival protests break out in several U.S. states, with one group demanding vote counting to stop while the other asks counting to continue. And the World Health Organization warns of the explosion of coronavirus cases in Europe and rising mortality rates. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Final results are trickling in for a few remaining states in the U.S. where incumbent President Donald Trump is battling former Vice President Joe Biden. The race is tight in Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Biden needs only six more electoral votes to secure the 270 required to win the nail-biter contest. Trump has won 214. He claimed victory on Wednesday before millions of votes were counted. He is now demanding an end to the vote counting, alleging voter fraud. His campaign has announced that a lawsuit is going to be filed in Nevada. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is an international observer to the U.S. election. The group accused Donald Trump of gross abuse of office by questioning the soundness of the election. Meanwhile, protests and violence from supporters of both U.S. presidential candidates have erupted in several cities as vote counting is underway. In New York, supporters of President Donald Trump demanded a thorough recount of ballots. They also called for racial justice. Police arrested at least 50 demonstrators after violence broke out. In Portland, 11 people were arrested as protests continued throughout the night. Authorities said the National Guard was deployed due to widespread violence. Clashes also took place in Washington, D.C. and several other cities. In Detroit, Trump supporters demonstrated outside an election facility and called for suspension of the count. Supporters of former Vice President Joe Biden expressed mounting fears that the Republican incumbent might not accept the election results if he were to lose. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Ronnie Curvello, in Miami, who gave us an update on the post-election protests across the United States.
The protests that we have seen from the Trump camp so far, I will talk about the Biden camp as well, the supporters of Biden. But as far as the Trump camp, what I can say is that depends where. For example, in Philadelphia or in Georgia, the protests are asking to stop counting. No, you don't need to count any more votes. In Arizona, they are asking to keep counting. So all depends on the situation of where Trump is heading. If he's losing, they want to stop. He wants to stop the vote, the counting of votes. If he is losing, they want to continue the counting of votes. So, but in the Biden's camp, the movement is more is being taken over by the Black Lives Matter movement. And of course, the police brutality that we haven't seen in the years, many years now, of course, it tends to increase, especially on those moments of uncertainty.
Our correspondent in Washington, D.C. says Donald Trump will engage in an all-out legal battle to overturn the results of the election should he lose the vote.
Well, what we know for sure is that the president will try to fight this in courts, especially if he doesn't come out to be the victor. Now, if he does come out to be the victor, we can expect that any type of recalcitrance, any type of resistance to the results will be dashed away. But if it is shown, or if it is announced, or if it is alluded to in a strong way, or if it is official that the former vice president does win the election, beating out the current president, we can imagine that the president will fight tooth and nail to put this into the courts, to try to litigate this as much as possible before January, before he really has to exit the White House.
Europe is witnessing a surge in coronavirus cases and deaths, prompting several governments to implement strict lockdown measures to slow the spread of the pandemic. Poland registered over 27,000 new coronavirus infections, breaking its daily record. Greece also announced a three-week lockdown due to a surge in daily COVID-19 cases. So far, 673 people have died from the disease in Greece. Elsewhere in Europe, Russia said the coronavirus situation in the country was alarming after the country reported a near-daily record of some 20,000 new cases. Ukraine, Germany, and the Czech Republic have all reported new daily records of infection. Several European countries, including France, Germany, and England, have already imposed new month-long lockdowns to combat the virus resurgence. Meanwhile, the European Union has warned the bloc's economy will not return to pre-coronavirus levels before 2023.
The depth of the recession in 2020 and the speed of the recovery in 2021 and 2022 are expected to vary widely across member states. Nearly half of our member states are not expected to recover their pre-pandemic level of GDP by the end of 2022.
In a news conference in Brussels, the EU's Economic Affairs Commissioner said a recovery of Europe's economy has been interrupted by the second wave of the pandemic. Paolo Gentiloni said the Eurozone economy will now grow much slower next year than what was predicted in July. The outbreak of the novel coronavirus has dealt a major blow to global economies. As a result, unemployment rates have soared in many countries. Now it is time for this edition of the News Review. The World Health Organization says an explosion of COVID-19 cases is seen in Europe, while mortality rates are also rising in the continent. The WHO's regional director for Europe warned that in only a couple of days there will be an increase of 1 million cases in the continent. Hans Kult also noted that the mortality rate is also rising, but at a slower pace. European governments have implemented strict lockdown measures to stem the second wave of the pandemic. On Thursday, the continent emerged as accounting for the largest number of infections in the world. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Jerm Hughes from Brussels and also Robert Inlakish, our other correspondent live from London. Thanks to both of you. Let's begin from Brussels. And Jerm Hughes, if you could give us an update on the situation there, firsthand information which you're experiencing right now.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting what's happening here in Belgium, because we just don't know yet if the restrictions that were implemented about 3 weeks ago, you know, this was the first country in the region to start implementing very heavy restrictions in terms of closing down cafes and restaurants and so on. A lot of people very upset about that. Some people saying the restrictions go too far. Others are saying they weren't implemented quickly enough. And if you do it sooner, then you start getting the cases down quicker. But, you know, here it's hard to know whether that's working, because if you look at the figures, I mean, today, Thursday, we had new figures out this morning, 15,000 additional cases, 205 additional deaths. But if you look back, say, the 31st of October, what was that, Saturday? So, you know, you're talking then there were around 20,000 cases, and then it slowly went down and you had something like 14, then 11. A couple of days ago, we had just 5,000 new coronavirus cases here in Belgium. And it's back up again to 15. Maybe today is a bit of a blip on the graph. Could be to do with the amount of testing and so on. Maybe we are seeing a downward curve since the 31st of October, and maybe that is because of these restrictions 3 weeks ago. But it'll take another week or so to figure out if this is a trend going downwards and whether these lockdowns really are having the effect that the authorities want. But, I mean, elsewhere, France, as you mentioned earlier, you know, an extra 40,500 cases, 385 additional deaths. I know you're going to be talking about the UK, but, you know, an extra 25,000 plus cases in Spain and the UK, a lot of deaths there as well. And Italy, 30,500 additional cases, 352 deaths.
Thank you very much, Jerome. Let's go to London and talk to Robert and Lakesh to find out what's happening exactly in London right now and in the UK, basically.
Well, what we do know, of course, is that there was a reported 492 COVID-19 deaths, according to the most authoritative sources, yesterday. And, of course, this comes in line with predictions that perhaps if the government didn't do anything in the country, we could reach 4,000 deaths a day. These projections put forth by SAGE, which is a scientific advisory organization to the government. However, of course, with that, we've had members of SAGE come out and say that perhaps these projections were a little bit too high. And amongst the population going into the lockdown today, there is a huge divide in terms of people that think this should have been done sooner, that the government should have acted sooner, and also that the government should have taken harsher measures now as well with this second lockdown that we're going into. And on the other side, a lot of people are very concerned about what this means for the British economy going into a second lockdown. We've seen that the new infections are up just 1.9% from last week. That is a rise, of course, and the British government claims to have been doing something about this, but many people are disputing, you know, whether this is actually going to make any sort of tangible difference in the country, as, for instance, the places where we're seeing most of these cases rise are still open, and there's been little to no restrictions on many different areas where there is the biggest spikes in COVID-19 spread. I believe that many people at the moment are, and on both sides, against the government and what it has been implemented. People, of course, are very anxious about the potential of, you know, going up above what was happening in May in terms of the death statistics and also the infections.
Well, it seems that it's the same all across Europe. Let's go back to Brussels. Are we hearing anything from healthcare officials here?
Well, in terms of, you know, the big hope at the moment, obviously, is the vaccine. And way back, you know, a couple of months ago, the European Commission was saying that it expected to have two working vaccines before Christmas and that there would be widespread distribution in April. So, you know, we're now into November. Are we going to get a vaccine in November? Are we going to get a vaccine in December? And also a lot of concern about, is the European Union in a position to distribute a vaccine effectively? We saw the chaos at the start when they closed borders and so on, and there was a lack of coordination in terms of sharing medical supplies and that type of thing. The European Commission is at pains to stress to countries that it needs to have the necessary vehicles, you know, with low temperatures to be able to transport vaccines. Countries need to be prepared in terms of training up health professionals, but not just health professionals, but ordinary sort of citizens to be trained up to be able to administer the vaccine, because it's going to be a massive project to try and get the frontline health workers vaccinated, the most vulnerable in terms of the elderly and those with underlying health conditions. But, you know, all of that is theoretical in one sense, because we just don't have an approved vaccine yet. And that is what everyone is hoping for, because we know that the first lockdowns did work in terms of lowering the number of transmission cases. However, you know, the second lockdown, will that work as well? Because citizens are so sick and tired of the restrictions that perhaps they're more likely to gather in, you know, domestic settings, houses, apartments and so on, socializing together because of the fatigue. Maybe they will not adhere to the restrictions like they did the first time around, and that is a concern, to see whether or not this these restrictions work. But we did see the first country in the EU to do a nationwide lockdown was Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. We do see cases there going down. The transmission rate is going down. The hospitalizations are going down. The number of people going into intensive care units is decreasing. So that is working there.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to London. Is the healthcare system there prepared for this load?
Well, of course, we're hearing that at the moment it could become overburdened if the cases rise to the numbers that were projected by Sage. Of course, at the moment, there hasn't been reporting that it's completely overburdened in the United Kingdom. In fact, some places in the UK as well have little to no cases, and they were also locked down. And so a lot of people are saying that, for instance, it's having an effect on other people coming in and getting diagnoses for things like heart disease and for cancer and all different diseases which people usually would go and get checked up for. And a lot of people are of course, not going to the NHS for things that they would usually go to it for. And so, of course, this is another problem that has been posed. On top of this as well, many people are saying that, for instance, they've locked down gyms and shops. But, you know, in a lot of different areas, for instance, the schools and universities are still open this time. Public transport is packed on a daily basis. I myself using it on a daily basis will witness this. Anybody that uses public transport will witness this, that, you know, trains will just be absolutely packed up to the brink. And so a lot of these measures that are being introduced, it seems almost like it would have a very small effect on what's happening. However, we don't yet know whether it's going to have any sort of an effect, because we see these spikes irrespective of whether the lockdown comes in or is not in place. And whether these restrictions have been placed in, we're going from the tier system, the tier 1, 2, and 3 system in different parts of the country, and we transitioned to this lockdown now. And I think the main thing for people and the main sticking point for the British public at the moment is, how is the government going to, you know, keep people economically stable at the moment? That's something that people are really asking the questions for. And if the statistics prove to be on the rise, then is there a possibility that the government has to implement even harsher lockdown conditions so that they can tackle the disease? And we know that, for instance, the WHO is came out and said that sometimes, you know, lockdowns are not the best thing because of other things they may cause as well. So if the lockdown here, you know, if the right economic injections into the economy aren't placed, then perhaps it could be to the detriment of the British people if it's knocked down correctly.
Thank you very much, Robert Inlakish, our correspondent from London, and Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for the elaborations, and thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review. And now, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the book, The Room Where It Happened, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton reiterates President Donald Trump's quote three times, that for United States, the EU is worse than China, only smaller. The building of the modern global trade system was a project led by the United States and Europe over several decades following the Second World War. Donald Trump's America First trade policy has been specially self-destructive. He sees every trade issue as a zero-sum battle that the United States must win at all costs, precluding any cooperation that serves both sides' interests. But it should be just as clear that a victory by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in November would not heal all wounds in the U.S.-European Union relationship. The fact is that in the countries on both sides of the Atlantic, proponents of free trade as the solution to all political impasses do not consider that communism and socialism are not the most important rivals and enemies of the free market. Rather, it is the free economies of other hegemons and countries. We now present you an article written by Farshid Faranakian, an Iranian attorney at law who holds a PhD in oil and gas law. The piece is titled, "For US, EU is worse than China, only smaller in transatlantic trade disputes." Please stay with us for more of Farshid Faranakian's article. Iran is mentioned 755 times in the book The Room Where It Happened, which contains 18-month recollections of John Bolton as U.S. President Donald Trump's national security advisor. In fact, among other countries, the name of Iran is mentioned the most in this book. Also, the name or title of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and President of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, and Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has been mentioned 28, 26, and 43 times respectively. This volume of attention to Iran and its high-ranking officials indicates that the White House can never ignore Iran's position as its vital role in regional and international developments and is forced to pay attention to this issue. Of course, the 167 repetitions of the name Europe in John Bolton's book, many of which have been used to express the European Union's serious disagreement with Donald Trump on various issues, highlight the importance of the outcome of the recent United States presidential election for its members. Donald Trump does not look at the EU as an ally or even a partner, but as a rival. The difference that is taken into consideration in the following of this article is a difference in perception of the concept of free trade between this union and Donald Trump. This difference of opinion is such that it has brought the countries on both sides of the Atlantic to a serious trade war. By the mid-1990s, the United States found itself in a position of primacy, unmatched in modern history. Its combination of economic, military, and soft power dwarfed all others, and scholars such as William Wilberforce and Stephen Brooks offered arguments for why the unipolar era might last as long or even longer than the bipolar era that preceded it. What these optimists did not anticipate was a series of self-inflicted wounds that the United States would suffer in the years that followed, a train wreck of recurring blunders that has accelerated and worsened under President Donald Trump. Before Trump, the mistakes of the unipolar era fell under three main headings. The first era was adopting a grand strategy of liberal hegemony, which sought to supposedly spread democracy, markets, and other so-called liberal values far and wide, and to bring the whole world into a liberal order that was designed and led by the United States. The second mistake was to allow public institutions to deteriorate by starving them of resources and then blaming them for all problems. The third misstep was the weaponization of partisan politics. Unfortunately, these three trends were also sharply at odds with each other. As Farid Zakaria, an Indian-American journalist, noted back in 1998, the result was a hollow hegemony, as the United States tried in vain to manage the world on the cheap. The consequences of these three errors provided the toxic brew that allowed an incompetent and narcissistic charlatan like Donald Trump to reach the White House. His only significant foreign policy achievement to date is getting Britain to decide not to use Huawei technology for its new fifth-generation digital network, but that's not much to show for nearly 4 years in office. When the United States and the European Union fight over trade, it might lack the intensity and geopolitical impact of the US-China trade war. But what transatlantic trade disputes have so far lacked in terms of drama, they make up for with a history of irreconcilable differences and sheer tenacity, which does not bode well for the relationship going forward, no matter who wins the US presidential election. Take the dispute of more than 15 years over the various government subsidies enjoyed by rival aircraft makers Airbus and Boeing. Part of the aircraft dispute hinges on a fundamental question that is playing out with the rise of China. To what extent should countries be permitted to bend the rules in order for their companies to catch up with dominant market leaders? There is no legal answer to this question. It requires a negotiated settlement, however difficult those negotiations might be. In other words, 16 years of fighting have achieved nothing but new tariffs that hurt exporters of unrelated products, and that have not helped either company. That self-destructive failure has set a template for US-European Union trade relations. Instead of finding mutually acceptable resolutions to trade problems, each side has dug in deeper, often inflaming public opinion. US-European disagreements have entrenched the idea that product regulations are purely a national matter, even if they are often internationally used to block trade. The ongoing Airbus-Boeing dispute was one of several that derailed the grandly named Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, which was supposed to be a comprehensive deal to align the two superpowers of trade at a time when the growing challenge from China was becoming apparent. But in 2016, after 3 years and 15 rounds of negotiations, the planned agreement died without a single chapter being concluded. President Donald Trump reiterated his threat to impose a hefty tariff on European cars, mainly aimed at German companies such as Volkswagen and Daimler-Benz. Donald Trump claimed that the EU was formed in order to take advantage of the United States, and he has frequently said that Europe treats us worse than China. The United States has also launched an investigation under Section 301, the same law used to impose tariffs on China, into new digital taxes levied or under consideration in the European Union and several of its member states. The European Union, in turn, has promised to retaliate in kind against any new US tariffs. European Union Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan warned that he expected an especially turbulent relationship with the United States in the months leading up to the November presidential election. The United States and Europe are threatening tariffs against each other instead of finding common ground. Corporate taxation is another battleground. With governments across the world starved for resources to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, they need to find better ways to tax global companies, such as Apple, that are increasingly effective at avoiding taxes. In the book, The Room Where It Happened, John Bolton reiterates Trump's quote three times, that for the United States, the European Union is worse than China, only smaller. The building of the modern global trade system was a project led by the United States and Europe over several decades following the Second World War. Donald Trump's America First trade policy has been specially self-destructive. He sees every trade issue as a zero-sum battle that the United States must win at all costs, precluding any cooperation that serves both sides' interests. But it should be just as clear that a victory by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in November would not heal all the wounds in U.S.-European Union relationship. The fact is that in the countries on both sides of the Atlantic, proponents of free trade as a solution to all political impasses do not consider that communism and socialism are not the most important rivals and enemies of the free market. Rather, it is the free economies of other hegemons and countries. Throughout history, Western European powers have repeatedly pushed other free economies to the brink of war or economic blockade in order for their free economy to flourish. France, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Portugal, and Spain have competed for maximum freedom of action for themselves and minimum economic freedom for others. Those who think that the free market leads to freedom and prosperity of all countries ignore the violent aspect of competition, namely natural confrontation and conflict. They want to follow the romantic theory of abundance, which believes that there is room for everyone on earth and that there are unlimited resources in the market, and that one can always reach a win-win situation by thinking. Unfortunately, history and the natural sciences do not confirm any of these optimistic post-Second World War assumptions. Trade tensions between China, Europe, and United States are the latest example of the truth that has existed on the planet for thousands of years. Market resources and capacity are limited. The free market is good, but for me, not for my enemy. A free market leads to the freedom and prosperity of some nations and the captivity and poverty of other nations. The free market is good if you're strong, and if you're weak, the free market is bad. Same as the forest is good for the lion and bad for the sheep. You may ask, isn't the free market itself going to be strengthening us? The answer is maybe. If sheep survive in the forest, maybe. Strengthening is possible only through knowing and learning, not through blindly implementing an economic model. That is why a unipolar world order is neither natural nor stable, nor fundamentally possible. The free market is not a saving religion to unite the nations under its flag. The goal of all nations in history has been and will be their economic freedom and the captivity of others. There is no easy way out.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In June of this year, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, FCC, designated Huawei and ZTE as national security threats, which meant that domestic telecommunication operators could no longer use the Federal Communications Commission, FCC's Universal Service Fund to purchase equipment or services from the two Chinese firms. U.S. carriers reportedly will need to spend $1.8 billion to replace existing Huawei and ZTE network equipment. In a further extraordinarily aggressive move in September, Huawei was imposed with a strict ban on the direct or indirect purchase of semiconductor chips and other products containing U.S. technology. The chip ban threatens to have a severe impact on Huawei's smartphone business, and some observers initially speculated that it could threaten the company's very existence. Huawei has countered by stockpiling supplies to survive in the short term and working out a deal with Samsung to supply chips manufactured without the use of any U.S. technology. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Robert Lewis, a lawyer licensed in California who has worked in leading U.S., British, and Chinese law firms in China for nearly 30 years. Under the heading, "Is the U.S. case against Huawei a personal vendetta?" The article has been taken from the website of Asia Times. Please stay with us for more of Robert Lewis's article. While the former U.S. Vice President and the 2020 presidential hopeful Joe Biden campaign has criticized President Donald Trump's China policy as erratic and impulsive, some White House officials claim that Trump has taken many positions that are in line with prior U.S. administrations. For example, as they claimed, Huawei has been the focus of highly publicized aggressive action by the U.S. government for many years. But the question is whether the Trump administration has pushed the envelope too far in certain instances. One step taken by the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, against Huawei and its Chinese telecommunications equipment rival ZTE this year may have escaped notice by many in the United States. In June, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, designated Huawei and ZTE as national security threats, which meant that domestic telecommunication operators could no longer use the FCC's Universal Service Fund to purchase equipment or services from the two Chinese firms. U.S. carriers reportedly will need to spend $1.8 billion to replace existing Huawei and ZTE network equipment. In a further extraordinarily aggressive move, in September, Huawei was imposed with a strict ban on the direct or indirect purchase of semiconductor chips and other products containing U.S. technology. The chip ban threatens to have a severe impact on Huawei's smartphone business, and some observers initially speculated that it could even threaten the company's very existence. Huawei has countered by stockpiling supplies to survive in the short term, and is now working out a deal with Samsung to supply semiconductor chips manufactured without the use of any U.S. technology. There is no question that telecommunications networks trigger serious national security issues, given the critical importance of the digital economy. So action to preserve the integrity of national networks is the exercise of government authority. But there are a range of measures that can be adopted to address these concerns. The Trump administration always tends to default to the most draconian response. Moreover, the administration's decision to ban Huawei from acquiring semiconductor chips that include any U.S. technology would appear to be intended to constrain Huawei's growth all around the world and to handicap its development of fifth-generation 5G technology. Critics argue that such a move is not designed to advance U.S. national security interests, but rather to promote the commercial interests of domestic technology players. That is not clearly a legitimate exercise of government authority in an open society, but rather an exercise of pure political power to gain geopolitical advantage. Moreover, much of Europe and many other countries around the world do not share the same concerns about the purported national security implications of installing Huawei equipment into their national telecommunication networks, although the tide is shifting in this regard. Huawei, which is a private company and so does not release full financials, reported revenue growth of nearly 20% and increased profits of 25% for 2019, notwithstanding the years-long campaign of the United States to persuade allies not to buy from Huawei. Meng Wanzhou may not be a household name in the United States, but she is in China. She is the chief financial officer of Huawei and the daughter of Huawei founder Ren Zhengfeng. She is considered by many to be corporate royalty in China. Even Donald Trump reportedly referred to her as the Ivanka Trump of China. She is now viewed by many Chinese as a victim in the ongoing business, diplomatic, and legal battles between the two countries. If the United States and China are to find an off-ramp to de-escalate current tensions, Meng Wanzhou likely will have to be part of the package deal in some shape or form. Acting at the request of the U.S. Justice Department, Canadian officials arrested Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver International Airport after she landed from Hong Kong and as she waited for a connecting flight to Mexico. Although she had a residency visa for Canada and owned homes there, on this trip she was merely passing through with no intention of remaining in the country. The U.S. indictment charged her and Huawei with various counts of bank fraud, wire fraud, violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran, and related conspiracy charges, as well as obstruction of justice. Now, almost 2 years after she was taken into custody, she remains under house arrest as she fights extradition to the United States to face criminal prosecution. Ironically, Meng Wanzhou was arrested on 1st of December 2018, just as Donald Trump was preparing to sit down for his private dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 meeting in Buenos Aires, Argentina. The commonly held view in China is that Donald Trump either orchestrated or authorized the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, possibly to gain leverage in the negotiations with President Xi Jinping. However, multiple current and former U.S. government officials have confirmed that because of lack of coordination and general dysfunction within his administration, Donald Trump was out of the loop and was not even aware that Meng Wanzhou was being arrested as he sat down with President Xi Jinping. Beijing has vigorously denounced the arrest of Meng, and Chinese officials have repeatedly said that her arrest was part of a political conspiracy to block the growth of Huawei and other Chinese technology giants abroad. The tripartite Sino-Canadian-U.S. relations were further strained when, only 9 days after Meng Wanzhou's arrest, two Canadian nationals, Michael Kovrig, a former diplomat, and Michael Spavor, a businessman, were detained in China and later charged with spying on national secrets and providing intelligence for outside entities. Canadian officials described their arrests as arbitrary, but China denied that their arrests were in retaliation for or otherwise connected to Meng Wanzhou's detention in Vancouver, Canada. Donald Trump may not have directed or even been aware in real time of Meng Wanzhou's arrest, but true to form, disregarding all norms, he weighed in publicly and repeatedly on her arrest in ways that may turn out to be prejudicial to U.S. prosecutors' case, and perhaps even to the efforts of Canadian authorities to extradite her to the United States. In court submissions in the extradition proceedings, counsel for Meng Wanzhou asserted that she's essence is being held as a bargaining chip in a high-stakes game of geopolitical poker between Washington and Beijing. The legal counsel specifically cited a series of public remarks by President Donald Trump, where, less than 2 weeks after Meng Wanzhou's arrest, he stated that he would certainly intervene if he thought it was necessary in order to conclude the largest trade deal ever made. In subsequent months, Donald Trump indicated that he was planning to discuss the Huawei case with the Chinese side and with U.S. prosecutors. Trump's willingness to intervene in the Huawei case is in line with his apparent interventions in other high-profile cases. In the application to the court, lawyers for Meng Wanzhou also cited to the president's statements and actions in connection with the Roger Stone and Michael Flynn cases. Michael Gottlieb, a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of the professional services firm of Wilkie, Farr & Gallagher and former special assistant to the president and associated White House counsel to Barack Obama, also submitted an affidavit describing long-standing policies and norms relating to contracts between the White House and domestic law enforcement officials regarding active criminal investigations and prosecutions. Such policies are designed to avoid even the appearance of political interference in criminal matters. Michael Gottlieb asserted that Trump's statements shattered long-held policies and norms enshrined in over 50 years of administration policy. These arguments are undercut to some extent by the fact that the investigations of Huawei started during the Obama era and were conducted independently by the Department of Justice without coordination with the other so-called China initiatives of the Trump White House. In fact, some White House officials claimed it is probably safe to say that Donald Trump would have objected to the arrest of Meng Wanzhou just as he was sitting down with Chinese President Xi Jinping to press his case for better trade terms, as that would be seen as a slap in the face of his Chinese counterpart. But it is also very plausible that once she was arrested, Donald Trump did see her as a bargaining chip, as suggested by his public comments to that effect. The Canadian ambassador to China at the time, John McCallum, found Donald Trump's statements to be offensive to the Canadian sense of fair play and decency, and publicly stated that he thought Trump's comments could be sufficient to block Meng Wanzhou's extradition to the United States. He went on to say that it would not be a happy outcome if the Canadian judge ordered her extradition. For his candor, Canada's ambassador to China, John McCallum, was asked by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to resign, marking the first time in Canada's history that an ambassador had in effect been fired. Just one more example of collateral damage in the era of Donald Trump. Many Chinese view the arrest of Meng Wanzhou as a personal affront to the Chinese nation and question why she was targeted personally. According to experts on white-collar criminal law, the penalties for corporate criminal conduct typically consist of fines and other remedial actions and only rarely in the threat of imprisonment for senior management. For example, no bankers were sent to jail in the aftermath of the subprime mortgage scandal, which plunged the global economy into the Great Recession. Closer to home in this case, global banking giant SHBC, one of the key relationship banks for Huawei, and which conducted an internal probe of its business with Huawei, which was integral to the bringing of charges against Meng Wanzhou and Huawei, had committed its own serious violations of U.S. sanctions law in respect to transactions relating to restricted countries. In addition, Huawei's Chinese rival ZTE was also charged with knowing violations of sanctions by engaging in alleged sales of embargoed technology to Iran and North Korea, and then for covering it up. In both cases, massive fines in excess of $1 billion were imposed, senior managers were fired, and independent outside compliance professionals were put in place to monitor operations, but no one went to jail. According to U.S. prosecutors, Meng Wanzhou was charged based on her own personal conduct and not because of actions or misconduct by other Huawei employees. However, for many people in China, her arrest smacks of a personal vendetta designed to gain leverage over Huawei, all part of a concerted effort to constrain the company's global growth. President Donald Trump's repeated suggestions that he could interfere in the prosecution as part of the broader negotiations with China only served to feed those perceptions and potentially weakens the case against her. So once again, President Donald Trump is the proverbial bull in the China shop, and it may ultimately prove to be counterproductive on multiple levels.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Under the Prophet's rule, Muslims reached the peak of global civilizations.
Surely we have sent you as a witness and as a bearer of good news and as a warner and as one inviting to Allah by His permission and as a light-giving torch. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verses 45 to 46. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, carried the message of knowledge, yet there was no knowledge in that society. He carried the message of justice. Yet there was no trace of justice in that society, and powerful people and bullying rulers dominated people's lives and possessions. He was the messenger of morality, lenience, forgiveness, justice, and kindness. Yet that society was devoid of such characteristics in the real sense of the word.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The society was full of unkind, bullying, immoral, ignorant, and prejudiced people who were unjustifiably arrogant and who had their hearts set on carnal desires. It was in such tough and fanatic conditions and in such a dry desert that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family grew up. And this 13-year period finally ended in the establishment of the Prophet's rule. He formed a community on the basis of monotheism, knowledge, justice, morality, ethics, and generosity. He transformed humility into dignity and savagery into brotherhood. He turned fanaticism into tolerance and reasoning. He transformed a state of ignorance into knowledge. He built a strong and logical foundation on the basis of which Muslims could reach the peaks of global civilizations for centuries and could rise to new heights which were unprecedented in human history.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.